All right. Hey, man. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks.
So are you in Chicago?
I'm in Los Angeles, actually.
Oh, you're in Los Angeles. Okay, cool. Is that home for you?
Yeah, it is since 2011.
Did you grow up in the Midwest?
I did. Yeah, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri originally, and I went to school. I lived there until I graduated high school, and then I went to school in Columbia,
Okay.
Missouri. For the
Okay.
most part, with a little detour to Boulder, Colorado for one really fun but kind of disastrous year of my life. And then, I started working for a record store in just outside of Columbia in a town called Jeff City, the same store that my girlfriend and business partner Liz worked for. And then we decided to go our own way, and that's when we moved up to Chicago in 2006 to start permanent.
Oh, okay, cool. I just became familiar with a band from Columbia. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Untamed Youth from Columbia, Missouri?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I didn't know them for whatever reason, and I was at Burger Boogaloo this year, and they're fucking unbelievable. That was a nice thing to kind of stumble upon.
Yeah, that's Deke Dickerson's band, or
Yeah,
one
Deke
of his
Dickerson.
bands, I
Yeah,
think.
man, that guy's incredible.
Yeah, he's a total maniac for sure. They weren't doing a whole lot in Columbia while I lived there, but definitely everybody that lives in Columbia is familiar.
Right. So Permanent Records, when did that kind of come about? Are you in charge of that officially?
Yeah, I own it. Liz and I started it together, just two of us, in 2006. We basically wanted we kind of wished the store that we were working for at the time would give us more of a budget and more freedom to focus on vinyl, which is how we saw the future of brick and mortar record store going, you know. And they weren't really open to it, you know. It didn't seem like a worthwhile idea to the owner at the time, really. And you know, whatever, I could see he was making more money selling video games and DVDs and stuff like that at the time, even though the CD sales were dropping off like dramatically, you know. But you know, Liz and I, you know, had collected records since we were in high school, you know, and kind of had a love for vinyl. And you know, we noticed that people who were buying music were coming into the store and being like, well, that new whatever or that cool reissues sounds great, but I don't buy CDs anymore.
Yeah,
So you're like,
exactly.
well, you're trying to run a business and keep it afloat and have job security, and you're like, well, shit, what do we do? You know, like we got to do something. Like, I wonder if people would buy records. So we started, you know, bringing in new reissues of things and, you know, doing what we could to get, you know, the used bins full of whatever we could get our hands on. But then it wasn't just really, it really just wasn't like, you know, what we were trying to do wasn't really working for that particular business. So we decided to go to Chicago after looking around at a lot of different cities on the East Coast. And we had even come out to LA, but we'd only stayed on the West Side, and we were like, yeah, I don't think this is going to work for us here. Chicago was a lot closer to home and felt more natural and stuff. And yeah, so we started there, and you know, it went really well right from the start, and you know, the rest is history, I guess.
That's cool. How old are you guys, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, not at all. I'm 33 and Liz is 4 years older than I am, so she's
Okay, yeah, we're all the
pretty
same
young.
age. I'm 32, so we kind of grew up with the same era of music and things transitioning. And yeah, it's kind of amazing how, the CD died and people really thought that that was going to be the end of physical media for music for a while. But it always seemed clear to me that records weren't going to go away simply because people like having artwork and something to call their own in terms of, if you're really into it, you don't just want the MP3.
For sure.
And now that's as apparent as ever with the boom in the vinyl industry coming way back.
The funny thing to me is that although it really wasn't, you know, a mainstream format, like vinyl never really went away. There's always been record stores, you know, especially in major metropolitan areas that have had a sizable, you know, selection of vinyl records throughout the years. You know, the only thing that's changed is the internet made it a lot more difficult to score something unique or rare or, you know, especially valuable for next to nothing at a brick and mortar record store, because the, you know, the playing field's leveled as far as information goes. So,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, in high school and in college, I used to scour dollar bins, you know, because I didn't really have enough money to actually spend, you know, more than $10 on any given record.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't fathom it, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
I was renting a house for like $300 a month or something. So outside of
mm-hmm.
that, you're just like, well, it's all relative. But I was finding great stuff, you know, well, at least in my eyes at the time, you know, I completed my Sabbath and Led Zeppelin collection really easily out of dollar bins back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And now that's
yeah.
just like not the case, you know.
Right.
But
oh,
what
yeah.
I was trying to say is that those stores that didn't give up on vinyl completely and that were really savvy about what was desirable and how to, you know, and good about getting good used stock into the store, like always did well selling records, you know, even
yeah.
in the CD boom, you know.
And those are the ones that have those are the ones that have made it through all of the turmoil. Like they still had it as it was coming back. They were making money when other people were trying to transition. The ones that were just CDs, they're all gone.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I was wondering, I was getting into the into Brown Acid, and I was thinking to myself how much it reminds me of you know, it's kind of, as opposed to like some of the nuggets that are straight up garage psych pop stuff, this is way more like, you know, kind of birth of hard rock, like Roots of Deep Purple kind of stuff like that. And I was wondering, when you go out to unearth shit, how do mm-hmm. how do you focus it so well? How can you focus in on something that you don't necessarily know is even out there?
Yeah, it's really tough because, you know, when you're dealing with vendors, you know, a lot of times, you know, the only way to find this kind of stuff, typically speaking, is to be buying from people who specialize in 45s and
mm-hmm.
then, you know how to categorize things just by listening to them, you know, because it's such an infinite abyss of, you know, mostly crap that you have to wade through to find this stuff that it's just, you know, phenomenal. But I have, you know, a few dealer friends that have different areas of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
One guy is, you know, has actually literally written the book on garage records. You know, he's like way into that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he understands, he and the other guy who's more of a soul and funk kind of guy, they went, after I've explained to them what I'm after, they know now, like, that I want something that kind of sounds, I just say, I want, like, the DIY version of Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, Led
mm-hmm.
Zeppelin, you know, AC/DC, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and now they get it, because they're previous to, I mean, not that, you know, Brown Acid is, like, reinventing the wheel, these genres existed, but people didn't collect them, these records, in a way that people have been collecting garage records even since the time. You know, Nuggets came out in like the early 70s, which is just after all of that stuff was like hugely
right.
popular.
Right.
So garage has this like 40-year head start on hard rock.
Curated and all that, yeah.
Right, so there are billions of comps of that stuff, and once a kind of area is recognized as collectible for people, all sorts of people get involved, and then all this stuff comes to light, gets unearthed, because it's got this very specific box that it can be put in, and that means you can tag something in an eBay auction and have thousands of people be notified when a new Garage 45 comes up, whereas prior to... I would say there's this bootleg comp called Bonehead Crunchers
mm-hmm.
That kind of, that's, I mean, I was into this stuff, but that is what made me realize that, you know, there's an audience for this stuff aside from weird people like myself who just always like outsider things that don't necessarily fit in a box. You know, I like the in between the cracks stuff. Like if there's a, already a label that can be applied and fully understood. Like, I feel like, you know, I love punk, but, you know, Killed by Death and Bloodstains are like two really long running punk comp series that kind
mm-hmm.
of like, it's all, it definitely all hasn't been mine, but it feels very discovered at this
right.
point. Whereas Whereas this stuff, I was like, wow, even some of my headiest record collector friends aren't familiar with a lot of this stuff yet. And these records have existed, you know, you could get your hands on them and you could play them for yourself at any time in the past since they came out. But it's just
right.
One of those in between the cracks genres that wasn't collectible in the way that some of those other genres have been.
Right.
So those guys, I totally tangentially got off the question, but basically, you know, I'll take a stack of 45s, pull aside things that look interesting, play them, and then have my mind blown occasionally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I find some things. There's also people who have blogs and stuff that focus on some of this, you know. Obviously, like, each different blog or whatever has like its own emphasis, and sometimes it includes this stuff. It also has other different genres like glam or whatever, you know, in
mm-hmm.
the mix, so you can kind of weed some things out of there and yeah,
right.
whatever, you know. But luckily, these dealer guys who are like, have been in it for a really long time and have, you know, collections of their own that are like in the hundreds of thousands of 45s, like, have this massive wealth of vinyl to go and, you know, dig through and discover things from, because these kinds of records, these privately pressed records, like, they're the things that when you see people digging through boxes of records, that's what they're looking for, not like some Motown,
mm-hmm.
You know, classic. Like, nobody wants, I mean, somebody wants it, but collectors aren't looking for Stevie Wonder 45s, you know, that's
not
a dime a dozen.
No.
It's easy to weed through that stuff and find things that look unusual and then
yeah.
put a needle to them and decide whether they're actually good or not.
Whether they're worthwhile, yeah, exactly. And, you know, as you said, it's not like the most commonly mined genre of rock and roll, but yet it's still pretty accessible to me. Like, you know,
totally.
You could put this stuff on for anybody that, say, like, you know, our dad's age that, you know, maybe never grew out of what they liked in 1969 or 1975, and they
for
probably
sure.
still, like, relate to it. They'd be like, oh, yeah, this is cool. This reminds me of Mountain or something like that. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Which is cool that it has crossover appeal despite being, you know, super fucking dusty.
Totally.
And I was wondering, the licensing, you're dealing with artists and bands that, you know, to an extent don't really exist in any capacity at all. Maybe they're not even alive. How do you go
right.
about securing the rights to shit that you don't even know who or where these people exist anymore?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, discovering the record is the key first and foremost to find somebody who, you know, who may or may not be findable is only possible with that artifact in front of you, with a label with an address or a name or, you know, even just a city or whatever on there is the key, you know? And
mm-hmm.
that's the beauty of collecting records, is you're not just, you know, collecting something that has music on it that you may be able to listen to on YouTube or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting this, like, you know, map, basically, you know, with information on the label that allows you to track these people down. So finding the actual record or at least a scan of the label art online or something like that is the first step. And then beyond that, it's just a crapshoot. You know, we've got somewhere in the ballpark of 40 or 50 tracks licensed for the Brown Acid series already.
Mm-hmm.
So we're off to a really good start, but there's probably like at least 100 more singles that I would love to comp, but I can't because the information provided on the labels isn't enough. There's no info on the band online. There's
mm-hmm.
nobody's name, and therefore it's impossible to get in touch with these people who may or may not be alive or may not be interested. So,
yeah.
you know, doing a compilation is fairly easy. It's just as easy as making a mixtape, you know, if you're willing to spend the money on, you know, production or whatever. But the hard part is actually getting the music licensed so that you can feel good about actually using it and actually get the guys in the band, you know, a little bit of dough and the recognition that they deserve, you know, and you don't have to hide behind the comp. You can put your name on it too, because there's no fear of retribution.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about losing your ass in some sort of, you know, being sued.
Exactly. And I've heard nightmare stories of that stuff, and that's not, I have far too much to lose as far as credibility and with the store and stuff. Like, I've always wanted to do comps, but I never wanted to bootleg anything, because it's just, it's not right, first of all, and secondly, it's pretty dangerous, you know.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, how much have you had to come out of pocket for licensing fees and such?
Oh, I haven't had to at all. Luckily, Daniel, since it's coming out on Riding Easy, he has taken care of all of that stuff.
Oh,
so you
cool.
have to ask him more specific.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, and then, you know, not only does the band get an upfront licensing fee, they also will get part of the royalties of the sales of the comp as well.
Cool.
Both digitally and I think part of the CD sales too. I can't recall.
That's cool. Do you, my favorite, at least of the ones that I have in front of me, you know, I got 10 or 11 tracks, which I believe Dave put out, and maybe this is just the first volume and many more to come, right?
Yeah, it is, for sure. We have at least 4 volumes worth of tracks lined up.
I love the unofficial single, the Raw Meat Cut, Stand By Girl. That, even if that hadn't been the single, that would have been my favorite of those first 10 or 11.
Yeah.
That is such a great song. Could you maybe, like, just talk about how you found that one and, you know, any old details about it?
Yeah, for sure. You know, that one's one that's been on the docket for a really long time. So unfortunately, when you get into dealing with records in this quantity and this far, you know, widespread and stuff, like, it's hard to remember the actual details.
Mm-hmm.
I got a copy. I didn't even have a copy of the record, but I, you know, the label art was visible online. And there's a blog post somewhere online, I can't remember where they talk about the record, and, you know, there's audio and stuff, and it mentions that there's, like, varying arguments as to when it was recorded and blah, 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 but it did say that it was from Milwaukee, I believe, and the only name on the label, because it's, like, the songwriting credit, I think, just says Raw Meat. So you're like, all right, great. Good luck with, you know, finding a band called Raw Meat from Milwaukee, you know, with no band members' names, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
At that point, you're just stuck with calling anybody you might know in Milwaukee or record stores or whatever to say, hey, have you ever heard of this single? And 9 times out of 10, nobody has any idea what you're talking about, especially with this stuff. But
yeah.
There's a if I remember correctly, there's a production credit on the label. The label is called Blue Hour.
Uh-huh.
And the production credit, I think the guy's name was Richard Paul Thomas or Thompson or something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I searched for him, and I can't remember if I found him in the White Pages or what, but I dropped him a line. I cold called him, and it was the actual guy. And
wow.
Luckily, he ran the label Blue Hour. And so he was able to, he had the rights to the song and was able to deal with the contracts and stuff. And even he was, like, fuzzy on the details of who was involved and the actual dates and stuff like that.
Right.
And that's how difficult this stuff is getting to be. You know, a lot of the guys will be like, wow, I haven't thought about that in 30 years. Like, I don't even know who are you? How do you know about this? Like, and a lot of these guys don't even have copies of their own, you know, the band members or the labels don't even have, like, a copy of the record, you know, it's like kind of sad in a lot of cases, you know, cause they did this thing because it was what they wanted to do. It didn't go anywhere. And, like, you know, they moved on, you know, and
there's the other guys who,
go ahead, man.
No, I was just going to say, it's like, you know, what becomes important to other people down the line might have just been an insignificant blip in, you know, the band or artist's history. You know, it's just kind of one of those odd things.
Totally. Yeah, you never know who might come knocking. So that's a good piece of advice to anybody. I guess in the digital age, it's a little different because it might be that much easier to just have a hard drive somewhere with everything you've ever done on it. But that is one advantage of making something physical, and why I encourage a lot of my friends and bands to put out records, like a physical, even if they just do a cassette tape or something, putting something out in the world means that it has the potential to land in the right hands at some point. Whereas when you're dealing, like, the internet's great for everything that is great about it, but it also is a complete and utter abyss of over information, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, out of control. But and then unfortunately, you know, that's the beauty of this thing is, you know, you track some, first you find the record, then you have to track the guys. And I know of a lot of great records who I have not been able to find anybody involved, which is a huge bummer. And then there's other scenarios where you get a hold of people and they're either kind of batshit crazy or skeptical, or they just don't want to give you the rights to do anything because of the fact that you're expressing interest. They now think that that particular song or their band is, you know, something like a Death or a Rodriguez or some kind of story like that.
They could make some huge amount of money, and it's like, you know.
Yeah. I'm like, and that's where I, you know, say, you know, that is possible for sure if the right person hears that record and, you know, there's a story there and they want to do something more with it, then cool. But, you know, at the end of the day, the right person needs to hear it first. And that's, I think, one thing, you know, Brown Acid will be good for, is exposing a wider audience to a lot of really obscure and almost unknown tracks. You know?
Yeah, that's awesome. It's funny you mentioned Rodriguez, just as an aside. Who winds up blowing up in these sorts of situations where something is unearthed is so mystifying to me, because, like, I hear Rodriguez and I think of Jim Croce, and I fucking hate Jim Croce. and like, why some people become famous in the process of this and others don't, it's just really, sometimes it must be just a matter of who, you know, who gets approached and who takes a lot of shine to whatever. It's kind of an odd, interesting thing.
Yeah, it's a total crapshoot. And I mean, that's, you know, right place, right time is always the key for something taking off, you know? And it's like, that can happen in the moment, and or 50 years later. It's just really a matter of, like, how who gets a hold of it and what the climate is for that particular thing at that particular time. Like, I don't know, you know, that Death single had been comped already, you know, Drag City wasn't the first ones to know about that. Like, that record was out there, had been bootlegged, you know, and that band has a particularly good story behind them, but so do a lot of these guys that I talk to. A lot of them mention Spinal Tap immediately. They're like, we were basically the real life Spinal Tap, you know, like, they all have crazy stories about their situation and having, you know, maybe taken a meeting with somebody just like, or Pentagram, you know, for example, like that story about them, you know, performing for Gene Simmons or whatever to see if they could go on tour or get signed or whatever. Like, that's a real thing for a lot of these little bands that have a decent local following, and sometimes shit works out for them and sometimes it doesn't, and it oftentimes has nothing to do with the quality of the music, you know.
Like
Zeke's, I think, is, you know, Raw Meat is really great. I love that track a lot, but it also kind of has this, like, ineptitude that I'm drawn to that other tracks on the comp don't have, you know. Like, that Zeke's track Box is, like, full on, like, no bullshit, like, incredible rock and roll. Like, it's not even like, oh, that's cute, you know, how hard they're trying earnestly and kind of falling short or like singing off key, you know, like the backing vocals on
It sounds like
Raw Meat are kind of hilarious.
Yeah,
know?
Just like the Zeke's cut, it sounds more like, you know, like a single from a band that, oh yeah, like this is from like our first album that was pressed on this tiny label before we got famous, but like we're still writing good songs.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is, you know, there's a million bands like that, so it's just, it's totally interesting to consider what makes it and what doesn't, and like you said, it's just a matter of where you were and what kind of effort you put in and what kind of luck you got out of it. It's so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of these guys, like, you know, there's tangential connections all over the place. Like one of the guys in Zebra, his name's Timo Lane, and he went on to do like some disco records and stuff. And like that stuff was like pretty hugely popular and like sold really well. And he's like still involved in the music industry and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy from a future comp, he was in a band called, guy's name's Alan. He's in Crossfield. That'll be on volume 2 or 3 or something. But anyway, he, after Crossfield split, he like, you know, worked in the music industry as a guy who, you know, wrote and recorded his own elevator music, basically. Like, yeah. So, you know, just because these bands never went on to do anything more doesn't mean some people involved in them weren't like just sticking with it and doing something within the music industry. And like,
oh yeah, totally.
It's pretty crazy, you know? And then I don't know, there's all sorts of just wacky stories and stuff. And, you know, Josephus is on this comp, and that's a Texas band that had an LP reissue, on Numero Group recently.
Okay.
So yeah, it's just, it's unbelievable.
It's a total rabbit hole, you know.
Once
you start going down, there's it's pretty much limitless, which is
amazing
to me. Because I'm a collector and I sell on the side just to, you know, pick up a few bucks and have fun. And so when I see, you know, people doing this sort of thing, it's just like, yeah, it's just great. It's kind of like every collector's dream is to have a project like you've got going right now where you can just I don't know. It's pretty amazing. Do you have any all-time dollar bin finds? Just curious what your years might be.
You know, I buy records every day of my life, basically, and have been doing that for 9 years now.
Yeah.
Damn, that's a good question. I've definitely found rare records here and there, but oftentimes not in the dollar bin. And, man, yeah. I should have a good, better answer for this question, but I don't.
Or maybe also, just something that rings, pops up to your mind where like, man, I really scored on this or that, and I didn't have to like, you know, pay my ass out of it to do it, you know, moments like that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, oftentimes when I score something crazy, it comes along with a big lot of records that I buy,
okay,
which is something that I do, you know, regularly anyway. You know, it's like some guy's got 10,000 records. You can't look at them before you buy them. It's an all or nothing deal. Do you want them or not? You know, and
right.
So I've done that a few different times and found things, you know, like, yeah, it's one of those deals where I don't feel like I'm as lucky as some guys are, you know,
mm-hmm.
like I know what I know and I find great things regularly, but I don't have like, you know, some guys are like, oh, yeah, I just went down the street to the Goodwill and found a $2,000 LP in the record bin. I don't have that kind of luck, unfortunately. I have to, like, really work it. And, you know, I get good things because I pay really well for them.
Uh-huh.
So I'm the bad guy to talk to. I'm not a lottery winner. I never win contests or sweepstakes. I don't go to the casino because I'm not that kind of a lucky guy. I'm more of a good or hard work, you know, pays off in the end kind of guy.
Cool.
You know what, this is just a little thing that happened not too long ago. I found a OG Harmonia LP at a garage sale for 50 cents recently.
There you go.
Which, yeah, I mean, I'm a big krautrock fan, so finding that in the States at all for any price is kind of difficult anymore. And
yeah,
to see it alongside Herb Alpert and Barry Manilow records.
Right.
Garage sale,
yeah, I always think of stuff like that, too. Every time I'm sifting through some cheap bin, like, I'm like, man, I really hope I find I really hope I find Gallo Mill by the Drones, but I know I'm not going to. Like,
right.
Just little things like that in your mind, but that's
totally
cool.
Sadly, for most of the records that, you know, I own on Brown Acid, and luckily I own most of them now, I've had to essentially pay the going
mm-hmm.
rate, you know, because that's just how it works. You know, like I said, because I'm shopping when I am out shopping at a record fair or whatever for the store,
mm-hmm.
I can't devote most of my time to digging through boxes of 45s because there's far too many good LPs to be bought,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is where the money's
which
at.
Which is where you're making your money, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm
yep.
buying LPs to make the money to pay the 45 guy top dollar
right.
for something rare that I'm looking for.
Yeah,
which
no,
is,
exactly.
It's all
I
the
mean,
same, you know?
It's like as cool as it is to hunt and sell things that are collectible and have, you know, big value, like ultimately the money and, or, you know, the money you're going to make to survive in selling records is off of, you know, stuff that people will buy for $5 or $10 or less, you know?
Yep.
That's,
yeah,
that's,
I only
that's,
have to find 50 Fleetwood Mac Rumors records to
exactly.
be able to afford a $500 45 that I need in my collection.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's
yeah.
a lot easier to do that, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny how that works. well, I could talk your ear off for a long time, I'm doing actually a DJ and record thing later this afternoon that I gotta scoot off to, but
cool.
Maybe we could chat again sometime if you're gonna continue doing this. It's fun for me to talk about it. I'm gonna do a big sample of the first volume next week on my program, and. Yeah, so I love this stuff. So let's plan on talking again if you're into it.
Sure, anytime, man. Yeah, I can go on forever. So.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for taking the time, Lance. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, dude. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, later on.
All right, bye, Jake.